I'm John Krall. The Indiana Authors Award dinner is this Saturday. In honor of the Author Awards, today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the way that place matters in writing. We're going to discuss what it means to be an Indiana author. We're going to talk about books, about writing, and about the state of literature in the state of Indiana. We've got a great group of guests: Dan Wakefield, author of Going All the Way, among other works, and the first Lifetime Achievement Award winner in the competition's history; John Green, the author most recently of The Fault in Our Stars and the competition's National Award winner; and Laura Wills of the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, the day's news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the Indiana Author Awards and about really the state of literature in Indiana. We're going to be fortunate to have as our guests author John Green, who is the author of The Fault in Our Stars, Laura Wills, who's with the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation, and in an interview that we pre-recorded, Dan Wakefield, longtime legendary Indiana writer, author of Going All the Way and New York in the 50s, among other books. I should do a disclosure here at the top of the show and say I was one of the judges who helped select the Indiana Authors Award. But right now, I think what I'd like for you to do is listen to this interview we pre-recorded with Dan Wakefield a week ago.
Probably. In Indiana, I'm most known for Going All the Way, the novel, of course, and then we, you know, filmed the movie of it here in 1997, and that was a great experience, and especially getting to film in historic places like the roof of the Athenaeum, where we had a big dance scene, and also the Red Key Tavern, which has the greatest jukebox of 40s music in America.
Well, and I would like to talk with you a little bit about Going All the Way, because we are talking about an Indiana audience here on this show. You had a little bit, when that book came out, a little bit of a Thomas Wolfe-like You Can't Go Home Again experience, didn't you? Or
A lot of people felt that it was being critical of Indianapolis or Indiana, but really, as I've explained a lot, that in fact, I said in a talk the other night at Indy Reads that, in fact, it could have been set in Cleveland or almost any place in America. The whole point was it took place in 1954.
Do you reread your work at all after it's been published, or are there, is it difficult to revisit?
Only if I'm giving a reading. I don't go back and look at it unless I'm, you know, well, you know, in the case of Going All the Way, I wrote the movie script of it, and that was really fun because I worked very closely with the producer and director, and we would, you know, we really had a lot of fun doing it, and it was great. It's the best way to write a movie script, when you can work with the director. So that was really great.
You've had two of your books made into movies. Yeah. The Starting Over was obviously made into a film with Burt Reynolds, and then Going All the Way. Which was the more satisfying experience?
Going All the Way was 1,000 times more satisfying, because Starting Over I had nothing to do with. Mm-hmm. It was more the usual author's experience that as soon as they bought the rights, they wouldn't speak to me, and I had to go buy a ticket to see the movie. And, you know, I was on a panel here once with Kurt Vonnegut and John Updike, one of the Spirit and Place panels, and Updike was asked about his novel, The Witches of Eastwick, which has been made into a movie, and he had that experience, you know, that I had with starting over. He said, you know, they filmed the movie only 20 miles, a town 20 miles from where he lived, and they never invited him to the set. He said, I would have liked to meet Cher. So starting over, actually, the movie, it was a nice movie, but had nothing at all to do with the novel. But going all the way, the guys who made it, the director and producer, mm-hmm. they loved the novel, and they wanted it, the movie, to be really based on the novel. So that was great. And it was also great because I came here for the filming, and, you know, Ben Affleck, who wasn't yet famous, was mm-hmm. in it. Everybody was great. Everybody, a lot of the actors did well afterwards. Rachel Weisz got mm-hmm. an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress in The Constant Gardener. Everybody went on the things. And the other great thing was that, you know, I was able to get about 12 or so of my Shortridge High School friends in the movie as extras. Mm-hmm. So that made it more fun, too.
When you were doing that book, what was the genesis of going all the way?
Well, I just wanted to write about those times in that era. And I wanted to write as closely as I could, for instance, about the way people really talk, the way mm-hmm. things they really said. And so some people were shocked by, quote, the language. But as I said, I didn't make up any of those words. All those things were things that I heard growing up and that everybody heard, or, you know, at least all young men did. So I think that's what any novelist wants to do, is really portray the way it really was and try to evoke a time and a period.
Well, in terms of that, I guess what I would quibble a little bit with something you'd said earlier, I think one of the strengths of that book, and I've read it several times, is that it does seem to be located in a place. And it.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing. You know, I said to that audience the other night, I really thought about setting it in Cleveland, but I have no feeling about Cleveland. I don't care about Cleveland. So I knew that it couldn't have any authenticity that way. And I care a great deal about Indianapolis and the places here, everything about it evokes a lot of sentiment and feeling in me. So, yeah, that was crucial. And I think all good novels are really rooted in a place. And, you know, you can't imagine, for instance, Faulkner writing a novel that's not in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just place, I think, is really crucial to any good novel.
And you now live back here in Indianapolis.
Yes.
After a number of years away. How long have you been back in the city?
I've been back since December 16th, and I haven't really lived here before that since I graduated from Shortridge in 1950.
What brought you back?
Well, a lot of things. I think mainly, you know, the last 3 years I've been working on this book. I edited and wrote an introduction to Book of the Letters of Kurt Vonnegut, which will be published at the end of October. And I was asked to come back and be on a panel discussion about Vonnegut at the Vonnegut Library, mm-hmm. which was quite wonderful. And I saw a lot of old friends and new friends, and it seemed like a natural next thing to do, and it's been great.
I want to ask, you know, we've spent most of the conversation talking about going all the way, and obviously since we have an Indianapolis audience, that makes sense. But is there one of your books that you feel has been neglected, or you would like to direct?
Yeah, well, a lot of them have been. But I'll tell you another Indianapolis connection. Mm-hmm. One of my books that I like is, and it's still in print, and is New York in the 50s, a memoir about that era.
It is a wonderful book.
And also a person from Indianapolis, Betsy Blankenbaker, produced a wonderful documentary film based on the book. And that film is really amazing. I mean, we did interviews with people like Joan Didion and Calvin Trillin and Gay Talese, writers of the era, and we have archival footage of great writers of the time like James Baldwin, and it was making that documentary film was a great experience.
Well, and obviously you mentioned you've got the book of Kurt Vonnegut's letters coming out that you've edited. Is there another novel or book of your own writing that is in the future for us that we can look forward to?
Well, yes, I'm working on one right now. I'm working on a novel, and which is set in Miami, where I lived for 17 years. I can't imagine not writing. And I think that's one of the great blessings of being a writer is that there's no reason why you have to stop. And so that's been great.
And I think this will probably be my last question, but I just like to ask, it's something I ask when I talk to writers, and that is, what does writing do for you? It obviously, it's not the sanest professional decision one could make if you want to make a lot of money, but why do you want to write?
I have to say, there's a great line of Vonnegut. He has in one of his essays, he says, if you really want to meet your parents and you're not homosexual, tell them that you want to go into the arts. But I mean, if there is no greater feeling than being to feel like you're in the flow of the writing. And in fact, I had that experience really about a month ago. The Indianapolis Star asked me to do some memory thing about growing up, and I sat down, and I just, this whole thing started coming back to me about being at School 80, where I went to grade school for 8 years, and the writing just, I didn't even know, I just was like taking it down, and that's, it's just a great feeling. It's the best high in the world.
Well, thank you very much for spending this time with us, and congratulations on being named the Lifetime Achievement Award winner in the Indiana Authors Award competition. That was Dan Wakefield. We pre-recorded that interview last week. He will be at both the dinner and the festivities for the Indiana Author Awards this Saturday. We're going to be talking, obviously, in this program today with National Award winner John Green and with Laura Wills of the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation. I would like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We are talking about the state of literature, writers, and writing in Indiana here on No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about the Indiana Author Awards today. And we are fortunate to have as our guest, author John Green, who's the author most recently of The Fault in Our Stars. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
It's good to have you here. And Laura Wills, who worked with me on the panel for the Author Awards. Laura is with the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation. Laura, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to start with you, Laura, real quickly. tell us a little bit about what all is going on Saturday.
Sure. We have a big day at the library on Saturday. During the day, we have the Indie Author Fair, which is from 10 a.m. till 4:30 p.m. It's free, open to the public at Central Library. We have a plethora of programming for aspiring writers. We have Meet the Authors panels with John and our regional author winner, Barbara Shoup, our emerging author finalists, and Dan Wakefield, our lifetime achievement author. So people can come, listen to our panelists, talk about writing, ask them questions. We also have the Indie Author Fair going on where people can meet more than 40 talented authors that come from throughout the state to sell their books and talk about writing. We also have workshops about how to get published, about poetry, children's books, all sorts of topics.
Basically, it's a festival of writing, a celebration of the written word.
Exactly, a festival for book lovers.
Well, and John Green, I'd like to ask you start. Obviously, I want to talk about your work, but what does being named the National Award winner mean to you? I mean, is it significant?
Oh, yeah. That was a great surprise and a great honor. I mean, to have sort of your hometown, your home state recognize your work, and particularly in, you know, a state such as Indiana, where we do have a lot of extremely talented writers, it meant a lot to me, and I was really, really thrilled about it.
What is the, you know, how did you decide you wanted to be a writer? It's a question that always fascinates me because it is not a, you know, normal career path. Or
yeah, well, when I was a kid, I thought about it the way that you think about being an NFL player or something. You know, it was a career that I dreamt of, but it never seemed realistic to me. It never seemed really possible. I didn't know at the time, of course, that there are thousands and thousands and thousands of people who write for a living in one way or another, and that the, you know, the written word and making your living through it continues to be totally viable. So I don't think I ever made up my mind to be a writer, and I still, on some level, don't feel like I quite am one. You know, I have other things that I do, and I never think of, like, I never wake up in the morning and think, like, I'm a writer or anything. I just love to write books, and I feel very lucky to be able to do it.
How would you say you don't think of yourself as a writer? How do you identify yourself then in the private recesses of your mind here? How would you describe what you do?
I always describe what I do in my mind, at least, as making stuff I like with people I like. So trying to find people with whom I can make stuff that I find interesting. And for me, that's what a book is. A book is a conversation between a reader and a writer, and the book isn't really alive until it's read. And so for me, that is a huge part of my, that's a huge part of my process, I guess, is, you know, finding ways to reach out to that reader and then having her or him, but let's face it, usually her, read back, I guess.
And why did you veer toward young adult fiction?
Well, the books I loved most as a high school and college student, many of them would be published for young adults now, whether it's The Virgin Suicides or Catcher in the Rye. And it's a unique opportunity to have a seat at the table in the lives of young people when they're forming their values, when they're figuring out what matters to them. And I wanted that opportunity. Now, in the past, those books were usually published for adults, but now we have this this really great and fast-growing way of publishing that kind of gets the books directly to their readers.
And they are phenomenally, your readers are phenomenally devoted. You've got a lot of them. We are talking about the Indiana Author Awards here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Tom, welcome to the program.
Hi. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing fine. Your question, please.
Well, it's not really a question. I just wanted to thank John for making such great work. I've been a fan of his books ever since I read Looking for Alaska. And I read that when I was moving into college, literally within the first 2 weeks of being a freshman. So everything the main character was going through and Looking for Alaska, like being in a new place, away from everybody, I was going through at the exact same time. And John has a really, really fantastic way of making his characters honest, of expressing how actual people feel in real situations.
Thanks very much.
It's really comforting. And then, ironically enough, when I read The Fault in Our Stars, I was going through a breakup. So all of the passages in that about pain and how it demands to be felt, and the character who was blind, who was losing his eyes and just freaks out, it was all just perfectly well done. Yeah, just thank you so much for sharing your insight into human nature with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the call, Tom.
Thanks. Well, I appreciate that, Tom. Yeah, there's this character in The Fault in Our Stars who's going blind, but he's more upset about his girlfriend breaking up with him than he is about going blind, which is reflective of an experience I had when I was a chaplain at a children's hospital, when I knew a guy who was in a very similar situation who was 17 and, like, far more upset about the breakup of this relationship than he was about the very serious health problems that he was facing. But yeah, I appreciate that. I do try to tell honest stories insofar as possible.
And I've got to ask, how does it feel to get a call like that? I mean, that where obviously, you know, in Tom's case, your books mean a tremendous amount to him.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, when I'm writing, I can't think about the audience, you know, I can't think about them very much because I have to think about trying to tell the truest story and the best story. And but to hear from them is where the real fulfillment, I guess, is in writing. Well, not all of it, but that's a lot of it. So I'm very grateful, Tom. Thank you.
Allie, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. Your question, please.
Yeah. So, hi, John. I just wanted to ask you how you're feeling about the adaptation of The Fault in Our Stars to the visual medium into film. I'm a film major in New York City, and I'm definitely nervous for you, but also excited. And I know that there have been some definite success stories with adaptations from books to movies and some definite, should we call them, flops. and I'm really, really hoping that it'll be awesome, but I just wanted to get your thoughts on how you're feeling about the movie.
Well, John, how do you feel about the movie? Thank you very much for the call, Allie.
I feel good. I mean, let me answer that question perfectly honestly, since in the hopes that no one in Hollywood is listening to WFYI right now, which is that I've had a lot of very bad experiences in Hollywood over the years, and all of my books have sold or been optioned, and none of them have been made. That's the good experience, actually, is in the not making them, because as long as a book isn't a movie, it's still possible to come to it fresh and to imagine it differently than you do after you see the movie. I mean, Harry Potter will never be anyone other than Daniel Radcliffe for forever. Mm-hmm. Part of me doesn't want that. But if it's the right situation, and with The Fault in Our Stars, it really was. It was people who were extremely passionate about the book and who were going to be very faithful to it. I'm more than happy to pursue it. And certainly, I've read the first draft of the screenplay, and it's extraordinarily faithful to the book. Some would argue too faithful to the book. And so, you know, that's wonderful, and I'm really excited about it.
We've gotten a tweet from a listener named John. And this is directed to you. I'm sorry, Laura, but all of the attention seems to be focused on John Green saying, please list five things that make Indiana and Indy great, a great setting for place or setting for writing. What inspires you?
Well, that's a great question. I really love Indianapolis. My wife and I moved here 5 years ago because she got a job at the IMA, and I was a bit reluctant to move here because I'd been born here, and and we were living in New York, and I thought, oh, you know, New York is such a better place to be a writer. Mm-hmm. New York is the writer's city. But it turns out that Indianapolis is a much better place to be a writer and the most productive.
Why so?
Well, because it's an American city. It's in some ways it's the American city. It's the city that encapsulates the things that are best about the United States and also the challenges that we have. You know, it's a sprawling place that's spread out and that, you know, like interacts with agriculture in all kinds of ways that New York doesn't, and you know, has that manufacturing history. And so it really encapsulates the American experience for me much more than you know, New York or Chicago or Los Angeles or something. And so there's that. That's extremely important to me. But I also am inspired by a lot of you know, things inside of Indianapolis. My book, The Fault in Our Stars, was set here, and you know, I'm really inspired by the the Indianapolis Museum of Art and the Art and Nature Park behind the museum. I'm not just saying that because my wife works at the IMA. but it is, to me, like it's, you know, one of the great cultural institutions in the Midwest. I love the Eiteljorg. I find that really inspirational. But then I get a lot of what I find inspirational about living in Indianapolis is in the little parts of the city that I like a lot. Like I like the people at the Speedway at 86th and Ditch a lot. So I put part of the Fault in Our Stars at the Speedway at 86th and Ditch in hopes that I could bring them more customers.
Oh, and how long have you been back in the city now? How long?
We've lived here almost 6 years.
Almost 6 years. So, long enough that you feel pretty rooted here. Do you think this is where you'll stay most likely? Or?
I hope so. I mean, it's not entirely up to me, to be honest with you, John, because I'm the trailing spouse in this business. But I hope so. We really love it here. And, you know, if a place is really at its core, its people, I can't imagine a place I would like more than this one.
We are talking about the Indiana Author Awards here, really, I think, exclusively now. We're pretty much talking about the books of John Green, which is a good thing because obviously there's a tremendous amount of listener interest. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Billy, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing?
Just fine. Your question, please.
Yes, I was curious, talking to John, do you, it's because you write for young adults, is there a certain amount of a situation that you will not go into, or do you ever find yourself pulling back on your vocabulary because you know it will be written mostly for young adults? I know you speak highly of, young adult readers and really don't want to belittle their intelligence, but is there situations where you will pull back on themes or on your vocabulary?
Thanks for the call, Billy.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. It's a tough thing to manage because I want to be conscious of the fact that my books are read by young people who are at this critical juncture of their lives. But ultimately, my responsibility is to write the best book possible and trust the reader. You know, I do believe in crediting teen readers with intelligence and with critical thinking. I always say that, you know, if teens couldn't read critically, then they would read Animal Farm and they would, like, turn the last page and close the book and say, my God, we have to go kill all the pigs. but that's not what happens because, of course, they're able to read that novel as an allegory. They're able to understand that, you know, that things happen in novels that that you shouldn't do and that an author writing about something doesn't constitute a celebration of that activity or of that language necessarily. So certainly in my books, you know, characters sometimes use words that I don't use. But I'm writing that way because I'm trying to write the truest story possible. So the answer to your question is no, I don't pull back. I try really hard not to pull back because I think that's ultimately what honors my reader.
We have gotten an email question from a listener named John. This one, actually, we can direct toward Laura, I think, so that you have a chance to talk and John has a chance to take a drink of water. And it is, what is your reaction to the fact that self-published authors are excluded from most literary prizes?
Well, I mean, I think it's definitely an issue that we as the Indiana Authors Award consider each year as we go through our nomination and decision process. Our award panel talks about it. But at this point in time, we have excluded self-published novels just because our award panel has to read a ton of material to come up with our winners each year. And excluding self-published is just kind of a way to have that first level of editorship that goes through it before our award panel gets their hands on it.
Well, and there's a challenge, obviously, in the fact that the very nature of publishing and the way writers connect with their audiences now has changed quite a bit. And could you talk a little bit about that, Laura, about how even the definition of what is self-published is shifting?
Yeah, and I think it's changing constantly. We do have a workshop on Saturday about self-publishing and I think it's called The Pleasures and Pitfalls of Self-Publishing, and it's just something that's constantly changing, and I think it will continue to evolve. But as far as the Indiana Authors Award, it's something that we'll continue to consider each and every year.
We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Alice from the UK. That's the power of social media, obviously, who is wondering if you plan on touring over there at any time, John Green.
I'm going to tour in the UK when The Fault in Our Stars is officially published there in February, I think. So I will be in the UK for 5 or 6 days. So hopefully I'll meet you then, Alice.
Do you know where you're going in the UK so we can help Alice out here? And
it's a couple days in London. I'm a very big English football fan. So the two most important things to me are that I go to Swindon, where the Swindon Town Robins play in the county ground, and that I spend a Saturday afternoon at Anfield, which is my my cathedral, to watch Liverpool Football Club. So I'm gonna watch a Liverpool game.
How did you develop that interest?
I think I was probably just a contrarian in high school, and I went to high school in Alabama, and I am a big college football fan, but I think I wanted an interest that was. That seemed kooky, but now it's become almost a problem.
We are talking about the Indiana Authors Award here on No Limits. Our guests are John Green and Laura Wills. I've gotten a tweet from a listener named Mackenzie who says, when you were starting out as a novelist, how did you keep yourself from getting discouraged?
Well, it's a discouraging task sort of inherently, not just when you're starting out as a novelist, but also I can assure you now, I've often gotten discouraged between books. And there have been times, frankly, there were times when I was writing The Fault in Our Stars and I felt like it would never get done and maybe I would never publish a book again. The way for me to get through that discouragement is to keep going. I'm reminded of that great Robert Frost line when he said he could sum up everything that he knew about life in three words. It goes on. So you continue. You continue because we're lucky to be humans in this world today, and we're lucky to have the opportunity to observe the universe, and writing is one important way of doing that.
We are talking about the Indiana Author Awards with John Green, and we've gotten an email question from a listener named Liz, who says she's an Indy native who moved to Cincinnati, and I got to read the whole thing because it introduces a term that we haven't gotten into this show yet. I have a younger sister, and watching her go through high school as a nerd fighter and a member of show choir and as a generally smart kid, I kept realizing how different her high school experience is from mine 10 years ago. She's popular, she has friends, and she's totally out about her nerdiness in a way that I never would have been. Your community of fans and followers on YouTube, Nerd Fighters, seem to be one of the growing number of forums in which kids are encouraged to be smart and enthusiastic. What are your guest thoughts on the permissibility of being a geek, how it is changing, and how we can encourage it to change? I guess I'll amend that first. Could you explain for those relative few people, apparently, who don't know what Nerd Fighters are, what a Nerd Fighter is?
Nerd Fighters are the people who watch the videos that my brother and I have been making on YouTube for the last 6 years. And just to clarify, they don't fight nerds because we are nerds. So we fight for nerds, for intellectualism, and for to celebrate nerd culture, I guess. But as to the question, like I'm really thrilled to be a part of the movement, the movements on the internet that have done so much to sort of normalize not just nerdiness, but more importantly to me, passion and enthusiasm and unironic emotion. It's great to see, you know, we have that. When I was a kid, you often heard people criticize other people for saying, by saying like, oh, you're geeking out. You're geeking out about this and you're embarrassing yourself. Well, you know, this is the only life that we know we have, and what an astonishing opportunity it is. And yes, I am geeking out about it because it is amazing. And I love to see that passion in young people and that enthusiasm. And I love it when they don't feel like they need to be that have to experience that ironic detachment in order to find a social group that will accept them. And so, you know, it's really important to us to try to build spaces where those people can be enthusiastic and can be passionate and can see their passion celebrated.
We are talking about the Indiana Author Awards here on No Limits. My guests are John Green, who is an author, most recently of The Fault in Our Stars, and Laura Wills with the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about the Indiana Author Awards today, and my guests are author John Green, most recently of The Fault in Our Stars, and Laura Wills of the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Claire, and this one's for Laura, so you don't feel lonely and left out here. What is the best part of being involved in this celebration of literature? What do you take from the experience?
For me, it's just getting to know all these Indiana authors that I might not have known about if it weren't for the Indiana Authors Award. Obviously, I was familiar with John and his work, but some of our emerging authors and getting to read their works and just realizing the depth of talent that we have right here in our state has been amazing. And learning about these works and reading them and sharing them with my friends and family and people that I work with has been a really great experience.
And John, we've gotten a tweet for you that says, what was the inspiration for The Fault in Our Stars? That's from Sarah.
That might be my wife. probably not, though. I guess it was a complicated inspiration. The Fault in Our Stars is a book about two kids who both have cancer or mm-hmm. are in remission from cancer and who meet at a support group here in Indianapolis for teenagers with cancer. The initial inspiration was my own experience working as a student chaplain at a children's hospital in Ohio, but I tried for many years to write the story, and it never worked until I made friends with a young woman named Esther, who was a nerdfighter, an important part of our community and a fan of my books. And through my friendship with Esther and her family, the book suddenly kind of became possible for me.
We're talking about the Indiana Author Awards here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. David, welcome to the program.
Hi, guys. How's everyone?
Doing well. Your question, please?
My question is for John. You've said before that Looking for Alaska is almost like an autobiographical novel because you went to boarding school in Alabama and Miles goes to boarding school in Alabama. And in The Fault in Our Stars, it's all about a girl named Hazel Grace who has cancer in 17. And you have said that you have been except for being 17, you've neither been a girl nor had cancer. So how much research has gone into all of your books? Because all of your characters seem so realistic. So how much research you have to go into to going to these various cities? Because the books go throughout the continental U.S., and yet you're able to make it feel like you've been to every place and as if these characters are alive.
Thank you very much for the call, David.
Well, I have been to all the places I write about, and I usually have spent a lot of time there. I like to write about places I know well. It's not something I do easily, setting and sense of place and that kind of stuff, so I like to do it about a place I know well and care about. But as for, you know, research, it is a really important part of my writing life, and I think the life of most writers. I spend a lot of time researching, and some of that is reading, in the case of The Fault in Our Stars, reading a lot about cancer and people living with cancer, and also talking to a lot of physicians and nurses and families and people living with cancer. But, you know, in all of my books, I try to do a lot of research. But that's, frankly, it's kind of fun. Like, it's hard to say what's work and what's fun. You know, I mean, is it really work if I enjoy reading a book? Not to me.
We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Allison who says, as an author, how do you feel about parents who closely monitor what their children read to protect them from inappropriate books?
Well, it's really not my job to be a parent of anyone other than my 2-year-old son, and I'm really psyched about that. I'm really glad that I don't have to parent all the other people. So I don't think that, as a parent, I don't think that you should easily judge other parents, because it's a hard and messy business, and there's more than one way to do it right. So I certainly don't judge parents who want to closely monitor what their kids read, you know, because I don't know what I would do in that situation.
Do you read to your son?
I do read to my son, yes, but not
so what's he reading
not
now?
My own work.
No, I would assume. What do you Are you still at the Go Dog Go stage and all of that?
Oh, or? Yeah. No, I mean, not even there, really. He's a big fan of the picture book writer Amy Krauss Rosenthal. Uh-huh. And he also really likes Mo Willems' Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus, because it allows him to say no a lot with great passion, which is one of his favorite things to say.
Well, it is a great word. I'll have to learn it someday. This is another tweet for John from a listener named Brittany, who says, pretty simply, what will your next book be about?
I wish I could tell you, Brittany. It would make me a lot happier and more relaxed if I knew what my next book was going to be about. But I'm not sure yet. I'm just starting to work on a bunch of different stories, and I don't know which one's going to prove fruitful.
Well, and I'm curious about that in terms of the writing process for you. I was a newspaper columnist for years, and for me, the execution was never that difficult. It was the conception, figuring out what I wanted to say, how I wanted to say it. Once I'd figured that out, putting the words together was relatively easy. What is the most difficult part for you?
Yeah, the conception part is very difficult. And when writing a novel, there's a lot of conceptions along the way, because you don't just have to have one idea. Mm-hmm. You have to have, you know, hundreds of ideas that link together in ways that make sense and that will be compelling for the reader. And that's very, very difficult for me. I wasn't blessed with the ability to, like, wake up in the morning and have a great idea for a story. Like, I never woke up and thought, like, wizard school or anything. You know, like, my ideas are much smaller. And so that's the most challenging part for me, but it's also in some ways the most exciting part, because when those story ideas do click together and you can kind of hear mentally, you can hear that click, click, click of things starting to work, nothing feels better than that.
We are talking about the Indiana Author Awards here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Marianne, welcome to the program. Marianne? We'll try another line. Try that. Marianne, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. Your question, please?
I'm an aspiring writer. I'm actually a creative writing major in college this year. And I want to ask John, how much of yourself do you put into your character, and how much of people that you actually know, and how do you go about building your characters?
Thank you very much for the call, Marianne.
Well, here's my rule of thumb. Just because something happened isn't a good reason to put it in a story, but it's also not a good reason to leave it out of a story. And just because you saw someone do something really interesting isn't a good reason to put it in a story if it's not going to make sense. For instance, I got dumped a lot in college, and I would always write about my ex-girlfriends in a very direct way. Well, it turns out that's super boring for other people to read. it was interesting for me because they were my ex-girlfriends.
Or therapeutic,
maybe. Yeah, it was cathartic. but it doesn't necessarily make for interesting fiction. So to me, it's a question of imagining your reader complexly enough that you can figure out what stories they want to read and go from there. But you know, my policy with autobiographical writing has always been I'm neither for it nor against it. I'm for whatever's good for the book.
What attracts you to a story? I mean, when you're struggling with that conceptual problem, where do you begin to think, oh yeah, there is a book there. There is a novel there. I could do this. And not more to the point, not only is there one there, but it's one I want to do.
Yeah, a lot of it for me begins with philosophical questions or sort of questions about worldview that are very unsettled for me. So the question of why suffering is unevenly distributed in the world, or the question of, I remember when I was starting my novel, An Abundance of Catherines, I was thinking a lot about how at some point in adolescence or adulthood, you realize that you're not as special as everyone told you you were. And that's a devastating realization that this world is packed full of people who also think that they are really interesting. And I wanted to kind of write a novel as a response to that revelation. So it always begins for me with an idea, and then with the characters kind of springing up from that idea.
Emmeline, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi.
Okay. John, I have to tell you, first of all, I've been watching the video blogs since 2008, and all these years I still haven't been able to convince myself that you're an actual person and that you're real. There's just that stigma.
So can you say hello, Emmeline, just so that it clears that up?
Hi.
Hi. Okay, so I was wondering, what kinds of inspirations have you gotten through Vlogbrothers for your books over the years?
Well, the videos have inspired my work in a lot of different ways. I mean, one way, Emmeline, is that I read your comments, and that helps me to understand how people who are younger than I am and who have a different relationship with the internet than I do talk, and how they imagine their world and how they imagine their relationship with their peers and with the internet and with everything else. But also, I think the major way that it's inspired me is that I said earlier that I think it's important to credit readers with intelligence. And the thing I've learned from the community that's grown around our video blog is that you can never credit teenagers with too much intelligence. You know, they may be impulsive, they may be inarticulate at times, they may struggle to have the kind of precision of feeling maybe that that adults have, but the questions that are interesting not just to me, but like, you know, to Kierkegaard or to Kant, those questions are also interesting to teenagers. And that was a big revelation for me. And I think maybe you see that change between my second and third novels, which is when I went from being a writer who didn't have a popular video blog to one who did.
Thank you very much for the call, Emmeline.
Thank you.
We've gotten an email question, and I've got to do a disclosure on this one, from a listener named Jenny, who also happens to be my wife, and loved your book. Says, I read your book for my book club and loved it. On the surface, it's a book that is a great teenage love story, but as I got deeper and deeper into the book, I noticed the book was loaded with metaphors and imagery, some of which I caught, some of which I may have missed. I noticed themes of time and water metaphors, and I'm sure there are others. So do I need to keep rereading your book, like Hazel rereads an Imperial Affliction, to uncover all the hidden messages and meanings in this novel?
There's actually a blog that you can go to that will solve all of your problems, called Only If You Finished Tifios. Only If You Finished TFIOS.tumblr.com. Only, obviously, only go to that blog if you finished the book, where I've answered several hundred questions from readers about intent and that kind of thing. But as for rereading, I mean, obviously, I'm flattered whenever people reread my work. I try to write books that stand up to critical reading and that can be reread. But I would argue that, like, ultimately, the intent of the author, you know, whether I intended those water metaphors, it happened that I did. But, like, whether I intended them or not isn't as important as your reading. So I just feel grateful to be read so carefully and so thoughtfully. And, you know, ultimately, you've brought that life to that book, not me.
Is that part of the fun, though, of writing it for you, is that you craft this kind of story that can be approached at multiple levels, and that there are rewards, obviously, for the people who read it closer, and then there are rewards also for the people who are reading it while they're, you know, waiting for study hall to end?
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's something I really, really like. And that's something I particularly like about the kinds of books I write, is that they can be fast-paced and fun to read, and hopefully, you know, just really engaging reads. But at the same time, if I'm doing my job, they also stand up to critical reading and, you know, can be read in classrooms and in English classes. And that means a lot to me. But, you know, in a broader sense, the responsibility of a writer, I think, is to provide the most possible and best possible experiences for a reader and for the broadest readership that the book will allow for. And so I do try to be pretty mindful of that. And plus, you're right, it's totally fun.
Bobby, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. Your question, please.
Oh, I just want to share that my 14-year-old, who's now 17, got me reading your books. And I'm a counselor in a school system, and I love your parent characters. I just think they are wonderful parents, and keep writing those kind of parent roles.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much for the call, Bobby. Well, and that is something. Do you try to defy expectation in a lot of, you know, a lot of what we call young adult literature? The parents are either completely clueless or, you know, actively menacing.
Yeah, or dead.
Yeah.
Usually one of those three, clueless, menacing, or deceased. Generally that's the take that young adult novels have on parents. To be fair, I think that is some of the take that teenagers have on their parents. I mean, my parents were extraordinarily good parents, but when I was a teenager, I remember just thinking of them as like sort of vague annoyances rather than, particularly strong forces in my life. But I really appreciate that. And I do try to write good parents who love their kids, because I think that's true of almost all parents. I mean, almost all parents are doing their best. I try to be sympathetic toward all my characters and to care about all of them. And I am a little bit tired of reading about adults who are so epically horrible, because my experience of adults is that they tend to be pretty nice, actually.
Well, and I would ask real quickly, and we're running close on time here, how did becoming a parent yourself change that? I mean, does that it further inform the way you write those characters? Or?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I cared about the parents and when writing The Fault in Our Stars in a way that I never had cared about parents before. I don't think I could have written the book without becoming a parent, because I think sort of the central realization that I needed to have in order to be hopeful when writing this story is that I needed to understand the truly unconditional nature of the love between a parent and a child, and that relationship really can survive death, that love literally is stronger than death in these cases, because as long as either person in a loving relationship is alive, that relationship is alive. My grandfather is dead, but he's still my grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed to understand that and see that work in my own life in order to write that story.
We've only got about 10 seconds left, so I've got a real quick question. A tweet from a listener named Julie says, will you ever write a book series?
Probably not. I mean, certainly I'm strongly tempted because it's the best way to make a living. But I like writing books that end. Now, some people may not like where I end them and may wish that there was a little more closure. But I like writing books where you pick it up and then you leave the story and you know that you've left it. You've left it where the author wanted it left.
And I'm afraid that's going to have to be the last word. Thank you very much for joining me. Laura Wills, the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation, and John Green, the author most recently of The Fault in Our Stars. John, I think we're going to have you back, because clearly we've still got the phone lines stacked up and tweets that I couldn't even begin to get to. Please join us next week when we will be talking to Rupert Bonham, Libertarian candidate for governor, and about the state of philanthropy in Indiana. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Have a great week.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Public Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday at 1 p.m. for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org.